Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
They both dream of telling all the secrets that they keep. This town looks like lovers while they sleep. This town smells like paper mills and broken wheels.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Kevin Kirby? Y'all like Kevin? The lead singer of local favorite Mulehead, singer-songwriter Kevin Kirby grew up in Texas and now makes Little Rock his home. He has CDs for sale after the show, and you can find out more and get the weekly joke at kevinkirbylovesyou.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And tonight's show is in conjunction with the 2014 Arkansas Literary Festival. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has shared the stage with, among others, R.L. Burnside and Big Jack Johnson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and this week our featured artist is Rusty Wright with this photograph over here entitled Calico Bluff. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Rusty at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, we partner with the Arkansas Literary Festival, and our stories all hinge on pivotal moments. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Susan Elder has an unexpected decision to make, and we'll end the night with Jay Greeland as he finds himself on two different occasions at a crossroads. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Lee Clyburn as her pivotal moment comes at a critical point in Hold On.
I signed my name and wrote the date, July 25th, 2011. I handed the pen and the clipboard back to my doctor and looked at her for a moment, examining her expression. Was everyone judging me for my decision? The hospital bed was cold and hard as I slumped back with a sigh and waited for the pre-op nurse to start the IV. As I waited, my eyes scanned the room, settling on the curtains that separated me from the other patients. Ugly. Faded orange, sprinkled with green and blue squares. Who thought this was a good idea? I mumbled to myself in my usual snarky tone. It was freezing. The hospital gown only made me feel more vulnerable. The only things that helped were the light blue hospital-issued socks. I pulled them up to my knees and tried my hardest to cozy up under the stiff sheet and rough blanket. What will become of me? 16 years of suffering with endometriosis is enough, right? I heard the swish of the curtain, and in walked a thin nurse in blue scrubs, her red hair clipped back in a chignon. A few rogue strands fell in front of her green eyes. She had a delicate face with alabaster skin on the cusp of aging, but not quite there yet. She smiled, and I returned the smile. In a soft Irish accent, she informed me, "I'm going to hook up your IV now. First, I need you to look over this and make sure it's all correct." I took the clipboard from her and examined the paperwork. My name, age, address, and procedure were all there, all correct. I handed her the clipboard and offered my left hand. She tied off my arm with the rubber strap. It squeezed against my skin like the Indian sunburn my friends and I used to give each other as children. Then came the numbness and tingle. I felt the cold swab of alcohol wisp across my hands, which she quickly fanned so it would evaporate a little. Then the pop of the safety cap from the needle. The rush of the cold saline filled my hand and crept up into my arm. She hooked a bag of what I assume was antibiotics on the IV pole and turned on the compression machine that was attached to my legs. It began to hum. Squeeze. Release. Squeeze. Release. "I'll go get your family now," she said gently. "Please," I replied. She left, and there I sat for my last few minutes alone. I didn't have my iPod with me, so I had no music. But Try, Try, Try by the Smashing Pumpkins played in my head, a song that I had loved for many years. Try to hold on a little bit longer. Try to hold on, I hummed to myself. I was holding on, Billy. I was doing my best. Hey, love. It was Brock, my husband, followed by my mom and dad. They filed in and one by one gave me kisses and hugs. I had my entire family support, which was nice, but I was still unsure if I had my own support. How do you feel? Asked my mom. Fine. Nervous? You'll be all right, she said in her usual reassuring tone. The nurse quickly came back in and began to inject something into my IV. She fumbled with some cords and uncapped the syringe and injected some medication that burned a bit at first, but then a wave of softness enveloped me. I melted into the bed. It's Versed. It'll help you relax a bit, yeah? She said with a laugh. I can see it's already working. It was working. After a bit of slurred conversation and a few laughs at my expense, the OR nurse came in to discuss my surgery. Hello, Elizabeth. What's your birthday? July 31st, 1982. Oh, you have a birthday in a few days. Happy early birthday. Thanks. Happy flippin' birthday to me, I thought to myself. Everyone wants to turn 29 while recovering from major abdominal surgery. Can you tell me what procedure you'll be having this morning? She asked blankly. It was apparent she asked this question many times a day. Total hysterectomy, tubes, ovaries, everything, I answered in the same blank manner. You do understand that after this surgery, you'll no longer be able to have children, she insisted. Yes. I signed the form when I got here. Okay then, I'll give you a minute with your family. I hugged them all again. Brock kissed my forehead as he'd done many times before previous surgeries. The patient care tech released the brakes of my gurney, which jolted me out of my euphoria. It was about to happen. I looked at my family. For a split second, I went over the decision in my head again. Is this the right thing? I'm letting my family down. I have no children and I will never have children. I'm cheating everyone I love. I'm choosing to castrate myself, all because I live in pain. I can tough it out a little while longer, right? Wait, I cried as I sat up with a start. Wait, just give me a minute. I looked back at Brock. I looked into his blue eyes for what seemed like an eternity. He nodded, he smiled, he said, "We'll be okay, love." I looked at my mother. I saw the potential in her to be a wonderful grandmother, just like my Mimi was to me. I looked at my father. I saw the opportunity to teach his grandson how to throw a football, slip away from him, all because of me. How could I do this to them? I was an only child, their only chance. But then, my dad smiled and said, "We'll see you on the other side." That's all I needed. Okay. Let's do this then, I stammered. My last memories of that day were the rush of the cold when we entered the operating room and the icy feel of the operating table. The surgery went well. I woke up feeling a dull pain in my abdomen. It wasn't the usual burning sharpness of the endometriosis pain. In the coming months, I would learn what it would be like to live without chronic, debilitating pain. But in that moment, I felt some relief. Brock came in and kissed me on the forehead like he had done many times in the recovery room after other surgeries. I really couldn't say much because I was groggy from the drugs. I told him I felt fine, but I was just sleepy. He sat with me while I slipped into a restful sleep. After all of those years of holding on, right then, I was able to let go.
Lee Clyburn has an MA in professional and technical writing from the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and is an English instructor at Pulaski Technical College. Lee resides in Lone Oak, Arkansas with her husband Brock and their dog Gus. Aside from teaching writing, Lee spends her time reading, traveling, and promoting endometriosis awareness. Next on Tales from the South, it's very early in the morning when Susan Elder's moment makes its appearance in Waiting for the Next Song.
It was time for an impromptu adventure, right up my alley. Or that's what I reminded myself when my alarm buzzed at 4 a.m. My 6 o'clock flight to Chicago was the first stop in my journey to Valparaiso, Indiana, for a basketball game. Yes, that Valpo. I know, you've picked them as underdogs in your NCAA brackets for years. And now you know it's about 60 miles from Chicago. But this wasn't the NCAA tournament, and it wasn't the NIT. It's another level down, the CIT. And I was going to root for Columbia University. I've known their head coach, Kyle Smith, ever since he was a little kid, and I wanted to celebrate Columbia's first postseason play in 45 years. So I drove to the Little Rock Airport in the dark, stumbled through the line at Starbucks, then shuffled down with all the other airport zombies to my gate. It was 5 a.m. As I sat at the shared computer counter and skimmed the online newspaper, Al Green started singing about love and happiness on the airport sound system. Nice, I thought. When Carlos Santana followed, I felt like I was back in my dorm room in the early 70s. After that came Neil Young and Dusty Springfield and the Beatles and Jackson Brown and Van Morrison. Some of the tunes were on my personal playlist, and some I'd forgotten all about. I tend to think in song lyrics, and every song brought back memories. As each one ended, I loved the anticipation of what might come next and the surprise I felt as soon as I recognized it. I was in very good hands, musically speaking. I'm trying to live life that way these days, to just appreciate everything as it arises and enjoy whatever happens. I'm lucky to have that flexibility, not to mention plenty of Southwest Airlines points. For example, this trip to Valpo. I didn't know anybody else who was going to the game, but this seemed like the perfect opportunity to exercise my impromptu muscle. I continued to marvel at what seemed to be the soundtrack of my life and gathered my bags for a last-minute trip to the ladies' room. I made an offhand comment to the guy sitting next to me at the counter. He wore a cowboy hat and had a ponytail, and he looked about my age, give or take a decade. I realize that might sound odd, but when you turn 60, it happens. Believe me. I said, "Boy, they're pulling out all the old tunes this morning." He didn't quite hear me and asked me to repeat myself. I said a little louder and slower, "They are playing a lot of old songs." His face lit up and he said, "Want to dance?" It took a moment for this to register, given the fact that my morning fog was just beginning to lift and my stroll down memory lane hadn't included a partner. But before I could come up with a clever comeback, I realized he was completely serious. His eyes sparkled, and he smiled and waited for my answer. I said, "Man, if it wasn't 5:30 in the morning, I'd take you up in a minute. I love your attitude." He smiled again and said, "It's never a bad time to dance." I laughed and told him I appreciated the offer and went on to the ladies' room. I couldn't stop chuckling at this unexpected invitation. Now, dancing is one of my favorite things to do. Why didn't I just throw down my bags and dance? I'm on my self-described impromptu adventure, and I didn't take advantage of it. Well, there was that little matter of the ladies' room. So on the way back, I stopped again at his counter. I noticed a giant roll of blueprints in front of him, and for a moment, I wondered what might be in them. I said, you know, I probably should have taken you up on that offer. Don't you know that would have gotten people talking at this hour of the morning? We still can. Let's do it. He said, come on. And he was practically out of his seat as he waved his arm toward the open area in the middle of the curved counters. I looked and I realized it did look like a dance floor. And I was this close to joining him for a quick spin. But the song had just ended and a new one was beginning. It started out so slowly and I couldn't recognize it. I mumbled something about waiting for the next song. Maybe it would be better to dance to, and went over to the seating area near my gate. As soon as I sat down, I recognized the song. It was an old favorite I hadn't thought of in ages. Oh me, oh my, I'm a fool for you, baby. The original version by Lulu. I shook my head at myself and was just about to go back and tell him I was wrong about the song. And then they called my boarding group. I watched for him from my window seat as the passengers filed in. I was determined to learn something from this guy about his enthusiasm for life and how time or place didn't bother him in the least. Hey, I figured we could even do a couple of turns at Midway when we got to Chicago, and I'd do the asking, but he wasn't on my flight. So as I flew off into the sunrise, I was left to figure out the lesson all by myself at 30,000 feet. While I had no illusions that I was supposed to meet, dance, and run away with a twinkle-toes stranger, I knew I'd lost a perfect opportunity to waltz into the land of the unknown with open arms. And that sometimes great ideas just can't be planned out. You got to keep your blueprints rolled up and go with the song that is playing right now. Oh me, oh my. Dancing in the airport never entered my mind when I checked in for my flight. However, should the opportunity ever come again, I know what I'll say. Why, yes, I would love to. It's never a bad time to dance.
Susan Elder loves hanging out with friends and listening to her personal playlist called Suzak. She recently added Oh Me, Oh My to the list. She is also proud to say that Columbia University beat Valpo with a shot at the buzzer. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Jay Greenland has two pivotal moments in two short pieces. First, Pearl Harbor, then Ocean Springs.
Ed Butkowitz fumbled with a miniature bar of chocolate, his arthritically stiff and swollen fingers useless against the indestructible blue and red wrapper. One of his friends at the nursing home where Ed lives had dropped the bite-sized chocolate on the rolling table tray in front of him. All else forgotten but the chocolate, Mr. Butkowitz methodically examined it, patiently turning the little bar end to end in search of a point of entry. After a minute, he raised the chocolate to his mouth, but his stiff fingers and store-bought teeth were no match for the wrapper. He pulled the crunch bar from his mouth, looked at it, returned it to his mouth. I watched from my perch to the left of his wheelchair and thought I should offer him a hand in opening it. But the candy wrapper was wet, really wet, and big man me didn't want to soil his precious newspaper hack fingers with the saliva from the mouth of a man I had only just met. So to my shame, I sat on my hands, as it were, and watched this 88-year-old veteran's long fight for so brief a pleasure. Bad enough that I, whose most brave and self-sacrificing act for my country had been to memorize a Pledge of Allegiance, I was too delicate to help this man who had fought World War II for my benefit. I was too delicate to help him unwrap a piece of chocolate. And to make it worse, at that moment, I saw the sincerely intended words of bravado I had spoken to his daughter earlier in the day explode into a mushroom cloud of mealy mouth. Only hours earlier, Mr. Butkowitz's daughter, Mary Sherry, had been showing me the mementos from her father's time in the U.S. Navy. His story was of particular interest because Mr. Butkowitz had survived the attack on the United States Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. 67 years ago today, 11:48 a.m. Little Rock time, Mr. Butkowitz had been dodging Japanese bullets and bombs. Miss Sherry showed me letters he had written from Pearl Harbor, his dog tag with his fingerprint, his ID cards, and a photograph of a lively-eyed young sailor that was her dad. She talked of his large hands, the hands that once had enwrapped hers, big hands with which he had farmed and wired houses. He is a flag-loving patriot, she said, quit to acknowledge the service of others, never speaking of his own service except on nights when he hollers in his fretful sleep. I had said to Miss Sherry that one of my chief regrets is that I had never served my country in the military or in any other measurable way. Then, only 6 hours later, I, the Pledge of Allegiance memorizer who had spoken so regretfully and sincerely of my failure to serve, sat prissily by and watched as a man who survived the bombing of Pearl Harbor, who served the United States for 6 years, I sat and watched as he tried with hands a tremor to remove the wrapper from a bit of chocolate. I, who would serve my fellow man, would not even serve my fellow man. I watched another 60 seconds, then I patted his arm. He handed me the candy, soft from the warmth of his hands and his breath, and I ever so gingerly tore back the wrapper and handed it to him. The next morning, my shame fully registered. For my sake, a much younger Mr. Butkiewicz had bathed in cold salt water. He had eaten the inedible. He had submitted himself to the best efforts of the Japanese to kill him. And when he inadvertently gave me the chance to repay, in the smallest of ways, a chance to give an old sailor a bite of pleasure, my immediate thought was the unpleasantness of it. And when I finally did the right thing, the next thing I did was to dash for the hand disinfectant. David Harris Sr. stood on his back deck, his hidey hole as he called it, and talked of the days not so long ago when he could uncap a cold old duels at the end of the day and watch the night fall over the marsh behind his house. He can't do that anymore. Hurricane Katrina pushed 5 feet of water into his house, which is still standing, but that's the best that you can say for it. He and his wife built this house in 1971 and raised their sons in it. Down at the harbor, Katrina had smacked their dry dock business, which David Sr. had started to pass down to his sons. Everyone survived, but the material stuff of their lives was ruined and scattered inside the house and in the yard. I met Mr. Harris at the beginning of a week-long reporting visit to the Mississippi coast the week after Thanksgiving, 3 months after the hurricane. For a pathologically nostalgic man like me, who keeps everything his daughters, mother, father, and grandparents might possibly have even breathed upon, I have, for example, about 2 dozen pair of my now adult daughter's ballet shoes in various sizes. For me, the sight of the Gulf Coast was worse than disturbing. As Mr. Harris talked, I transcribed his words on a yellow legal pad with a prized pen, a Christmas gift, a heavy-duty ballpoint, blue acrylic, marbled with black, trimmed in gold-colored aluminum, my initials embossed in gold next to the pocket clip. It was one of the pens in my collection. I collect fountain pens mostly, but there's a rare ballpoint that is worth keeping, and the pen I was writing with that day in the midst of Katrina's wreckage was one of them. As I put the Harris's story to paper, the pen was about to show me something about myself that was rather unattractive. The storm was a double whammy for the Harrises. In the 2 days after the storm, they had moved what little they had salvaged to the home of their son, David Jr., who lived with his wife and children next door to his brother, Kim, and his family. Kim's house took on 2.5 feet of water. On the second day after the storm, David Sr. and his wife, Melba, were at David Jr.'s home, which he had built on piers out of the water's reach. In the living room above the carport, the grandparents visited with their daughter-in-law, Bunny, and their grandchildren. In the carport beneath the living room, David Jr. was trying to salvage his hurricane-swamped truck. He had hooked a charger to the engine. Next door, Brother Kim was cleaning up the backyard. There were about 5 explosions, David Sr. said. We didn't hear the first one. Flames from the truck blazed to the carport ceiling, which, of course, was the floor of the living room. Kim saw the flames and dashed up the stairs. We got out about 1.5 minutes ahead of the fire. I made sure the women and babies were ahead of me, says David Sr. When I was going down the steps, I felt like the back of my head was going to catch fire. The fire finished off what the Katrina had missed. As we talked on his deck that day, and I wrote notes on a legal pad, I gestured with my right hand, and my treasured ballpoint sailed out of my grasp, hit the deck, and slid between 2x4s and into the brush and pine straw 6 feet below. I feigned nonchalance as I watched the pen disappear, and without missing a stroke, I snatched the backup pen from my shirt pocket and continued to take notes. My inner pen collector, however, was anything but nonchalant. For a few seconds, I could hardly listen to Mr. Harris for fretting about my pen. And then the embarrassment set in. I was standing here with a 66-year-old man who had lost everything he owns, his house and most everything in it, clothes, cars, a grand piano, and probably every one of his pens. And I was fretting about a single meaningless ballpoint. First embarrassment and days later, perspective. Over the years, I have fretted over many quote-unquote losses. I taped over my second daughter's birth, for instance, and fretted about that for years. In Katrina's wake, however, I met people who had lost all of their home videos, all of their family photographs, and their children's refrigerator art, along with the refrigerators. Months after I moved to Arkansas, I discovered a box of my favorite hot tea mugs hadn't arrived. Not all the mugs failed to arrive, mind you, or even most of them, just a box. On the Gulf Coast, I met people who had lost every coffee mug they owned, plus a coffee maker and every plate, fork, and knife. Mr. Harris led me through his house and around to the back. When we reached the approximate spot where my pen had fallen, I mentioned it to him, sheepishly, and at the corner post that held up his deck, Mr. Harris bent over and fished the pen out of the tall grass. I was embarrassed, but not too embarrassed, to accept it. In the presence of a man who had lost everything, I wanted to act as if the lost pen really didn't matter. This is a man who earlier had said to me, "Despair is a luxury we can't afford." And this, "Everything I lost can be replaced by money. When you lose things, you just lose them. On a regular basis, you need to check and see if you still have all the things that money can't buy." So this man who had lost everything to the storm gave me back my $6 pen and reassured me. "Don't be embarrassed," he said. "It's a nice pen."
J.C. Greeland spent 35 years at 10 newspapers, including stints at the Denver Post, the Daily Oklahoman, and the Mobile Register. He spent 10 years at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, which published his thrice-weekly Sweet Tea column. His new book is Sweet Tea Tales. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience. Thank you to the 2014 Arkansas Literary Festival. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Shows the secret life.
lives of all-night radio. Okay. Songs that you just hate, in case they play your favorite one. And if they do, well then everything is right and true. The signal comes in pure and strong. Secret lives of all night radio. Meters that peak and lights that glow. Drunk DJs and late night punk rock shows. Songs they sing inside you creep, where they become flesh and bone. And through it all, the songs you heard you can recall. Then you won't feel so alone. Secret lives all night radios. Meters that peak and lights that glow. Drunk DJs and late night punk rock shows. Secret lives all night radios.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.